number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
Welcome to the Stuart Knight Show, where interesting, intriguing, and exciting people engage in unscripted exchanges of ideas, stories, and perspectives. It's not an interview. It's a powerful conversation.
Hey there, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to the Stuart Knight Show this week. I am going to be talking to my good friend, Doug Barber, who lives in Vancouver, Canada. Now, I got to tell you, the connection wasn't fantastic because we were kind of using a Skype and a cell phone connection, so it wasn't great. But as long as you don't have any major distractions, you're going to be fine, so you'll be able to hear it. Okay, so, and I think you're going to be glad that you did tune in this week, because during my powerful conversation with Doug, we get into some pretty cool and interesting subjects, you know, everything from what it means to speak your truth, to the intimidation of being a writer in Los Angeles while surrounded by famous people, to the evolution of the human race. I mean, how's that for a powerful conversation? So, here we go. Well, hello there, Doug Barber. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
We are officially recording. This is the first time that you and I have ever done anything like this. For those who are listening right now, Doug is a long-term? Doug has a long-term illness.
Oh, no.
Wow. That was a great start,
That's what I want to talk about.
Let's get right into it. No, long-term friend, long-time friend, and I appreciate you taking the time to do this. Before we get started, I just want to say, you know, and I hope that you're all right with this, I know that when I sent you an email saying, hey, I want you to be on the show, you said that there was some initial reluctance. So what was that about?
Well, all right. I mean, I guess, because the reluctance is, like, I understand what you're trying to do here, and what I think is the kind of probably the, I guess the key ingredient to have a powerful conversation is an honest conversation. Mm-hmm. And being able to be open to talk about what's there, and so clearly I have no problem doing that with you in private, but now we're attempting to create a sense of privacy, but also in public, even though no one's looking at me right now.
Right.
Except the guy with the leaf blower outside the window, so I apologize.
Yeah.
For that. Of course, good timing, but...
Well, thank God he can't hear.
Yeah, so I guess that's it. It's just, is this the question, like, how honest am I prepared to be? And if I'm not prepared to be that honest, how interesting is it going to be to anyone listening? So,
yeah.
Like, I'm not Howard Stern. I'm not, you know, like, I'm just, you know, so those are just the questions that I had. And
yeah.
And well, so, and I've been thinking about that a lot, just even in terms of how we, like, in the context of conversation, in the greater conversation that's going on, and or that's not even, that's maybe more chatter or clutter or noise than actual conversation. So, and that was kind of where I was coming from.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's really amazing how, you know, without a doubt, even though that it feels very much like we're having one of our regular conversations that we've had before, there is that element that when you know that this will be something that other people listen to, there is this subconscious voice that always seems to go off, even for people like myself who make a living being on stage and being exposed and having people look at him and is in the public eye. Even I find myself, there's that little voice going, are you going to say that? Or should you say that? Or should we go down that path? And what is it that we're so afraid of, do you think?
Well, I mean, that's a big question. I think it's, I think in some ways it goes back to our imagined idea of our very survival, and how we're socialized, like how our identities have been socialized since we were children, and how we're supposed to be in the world,
mm-hmm.
You know, and these are very, very, entrenched things and difficult to kind of wriggle our way out from underneath, and which I think is the central work of real adulthood anyway, is to try to get out from behind those ideas, or because maybe some of them we want, Mm-hmm. And maybe the way that we think we're supposed to be is maybe something we want to carry forward into our lives. But there's so much stuff that is outdated. And I think that, I think that's probably it, is that it could seem threatening because it's supposed to be, because how, like, of this awareness of how we're, supposed to be seen mm-hmm. in the world. And now there's so many ways where we can, you know, seek to be seen in certain ways, and how we can cultivate that image and identity that, yeah, I mean, I think it's a very, it's potentially threatening to that. And also can feed right into it, you know, like, so this is a great, like, I mean, that's what we see that in media all the time. You know, how people are going, like, we're all very familiar with the format, like an interview format or a talk show format where people are coming on that they have something to sell.
Yeah.
And so they have some banter and trying to make the selling of what they're selling as entertaining as possible. But, Yeah, so
you know,
I guess
it's funny. Two things that came up just for me was now when you were saying that. The first thing is never before in my life have I been more aware of this, especially with technology and social media, about what I am saying and how I am looking out there. And there's no doubt I'd be lying to anybody listening to this right now if I were to say that there haven't been times where I've gone to say something on Facebook or Twitter and I've actually stopped myself just because of A, I know that people can misconstrue things, and also B, I think that we are generally. Speaking, we're an extremely immature species still. I mean, I think that we like to believe that we're so evolved, but I can tell you that if I were to say certain things about sex or religion or politics on a tweet, that there'd be a significant number of people who would take that information and in an immature fashion wouldn't necessarily know how to process it, and then would just bring it down to its, you know, to some, I don't know, they debase it to some level that had nothing to do with what I was trying to say. And, you know, for me, I can easily lose a gig because of that. And it's just safer to not say it. But at the same time, to not say it, it kind of sucks, right? Because you want to just, I mean, I always want to just speak my truth, whether I'm at a party or a networking event or I'm on stage. In your own life, do you think that you, like, even when you go to a party or when you're at a barbecue or you're at a social function, do you feel like you speak your truth?
Yeah, I feel like I do. I feel like I do more and more. And that's kind of, I guess, one of the things I like about myself. And so, or I'm maybe being more discriminate about like what I, like if I'm going to say something, I'd like it to be is about what's actually going on.
Yeah.
I guess so. But yeah, no, I think generally speaking, like, I don't feel terribly anxious mm-hmm. talking to you now.
Sure. So let me, it'll change. Let me tell you about the second thing that crossed my mind, which was I had, you were talking about, you know, people having to sell themselves or people are always pitching things. And I just before this phone call, I was looking at some feedback from a speech. Sometimes when some clients will do feedback on a conference that I happen to be speaking at, and they're nice enough to send me the feedback on my particular section. And you know, I get good feedback, obviously. I've been doing this for 20 years. I better get good feedback now. And across the board, it's usually, you know, oh, we really loved him, excellent, loved the jokes and all that kind of stuff. But there's always a few people, it's amazing, that in the comments section, you'll get somebody saying something, and like this particular piece of feedback, verbatim, the person said, didn't like him, didn't think he was funny, thought he was trying to be funny, and I didn't know that we were going to be subjected to an infomercial. I was like, what? What the hell? And for me, there's that, because I know what I say, and I was speaking for 3 hours to this group, did a full workshop, and I mean, there was a lineup of people looking to buy books at the end, tons of people wanted to speak to me, so I don't get too stressed about it, but it's amazing how, you know, two people can watch the exact same presentation or hear someone say the exact same thing and interpret it in two completely different ways.
Right.
So, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm...
Go ahead.
Well, you read something like that or hear something like that. How does it does it affect the next time you, is it part of your own internal conversation the next time you go on stage and when you're reflecting or evaluating your own material?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. And I think that absolutely, on some level, but I think that's the battle. Because, and it's interesting that you say that, because as you were saying it, I thought, God, isn't that the battle for all of us? So, you know, you go to a party and you say something out loud that you think is going to be really funny and no one laughs. Does that then affect, you know, you making a joke at the next party that you go to? I would imagine that if it happened two or three times, it would. And or in your case, it did. Ooh. But with me, I find that, like it does. It does affect you a little bit, but I think that that's what it means to be a professional. And to be a true professional in your craft, you have to be able to process that kind of information and to be able to compartmentalize it in a way where you truly see what it is, and then and then not allow it to bug you. I mean, I used to get, I still do, once in a while, when you're in a public eye, you get negative emails from time to time. People who just, I don't know what they want to do. They just want to tear a strip off of you. And I used to respond to these emails. I used to be like, mm-hmm. Well, oh yeah? Well, this is what I think, you know? And now I just delete them for the most part. Once in a while, if someone's been absolutely out of line, I'll respond. But for the most part, I just delete them, because when it comes right down to it, you just have to recognize that human beings, man, we've got so many layers to us. You know, to not think that I'm funny, there's got to be something wrong with you.
Oh boy. So now, well, I mean, no, sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You go ahead.
Well, this is kind of why, like, all the stuff that we're talking about. I mean, how many of these have you done now?
This is the second.
This is the second?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Well, what I love about this whole vein and this whole kind of concept of powerful conversation, I'm happy that you have kind of drilled into it, or kind of used as a bit of a divining rod for some of your work, is because I think it's such... I mean, I think it's really an essential part of human development and our lives. Like, we're always in conversation with something.
Yeah.
Parts of ourselves, things outside of ourselves. I think it's highly, highly creative, and I think it's the central way that we move through our lives.
Does it concern you that we're losing it? Does it concern you that we're becoming a species that just talks online?
No, I mean, I think that comes with a lot of, there are ways that, I think there are dangers of it, but I think it's too complex to say it's bad for us. Mm-hmm. I think it just accelerates everything. But it's sort of garbage in, garbage out. I mean, there's still a call to go back to, this idea of, like, what's really authentic to you,
mm-hmm.
and what are you putting out, what are you uttering out, even just in this conversation now, or why you choose to post a particular status update, or how, you know, everything. And it just comes down to which part of you is wanting to express this,
right?
Whatever that thing is.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm kind of rambling a little bit, but there was this part about, like, the feedback and how you I remember there was because I mean I'm an artist,
mm-hmm.
I work as a writer, and I'm always sort of trying to think, like, I want to be a good writer,
mm-hmm.
But it's hard to sometimes know, like really I'm kind of the main judge of my own work.
Right.
Primarily, like, as it happens, like, or something that takes maybe a long, where there's a long development process. Like, I'm really spend a lot of time really just trying to trying to please myself.
Sure.
Which is why I don't get any work done. and so then you, to bring it out into the world, and you kind of cross that threshold with it, and then say, hey, everybody, like, whether it's me with my screenplay, or whether it's you standing on stage in front of a crowd saying, here's this message that I would like to share with you. We don't know what's going to happen, or like, and even if someone says, yeah, great job, or I don't know, it's a whole other art form to try to really get what people really have to say.
Yeah.
Or like to try to find the note underneath the note.
Right. But I like that though. I don't know what it is. I think that I've maybe sadistically come to a place in my life where I actually enjoy the unknown to a certain extent. It bothers me as well, but I love this feeling of, especially in the live moments where I'm about to make an ad-lib joke on stage, and there's that part of me, it's like, I have no idea how anyone is going to react to this. And there is this moment of anticipation that makes you so alive that the feeling of it is so good that even if the joke doesn't go well, it's kind of like, well, it balances out with the fact that just 2 seconds earlier, I was feeling so good in the anticipation of it either not going well or going well. It's only icing on the cake when the joke goes well.
Right.
So, no, how's that for you, though, from a writing perspective? I mean, you've got that script, you've been working on it, and for those who are listening, Doug writes for TV, he writes for film, you've written for video games. When you've got that script that you're putting together and it's complete and you hand it in, do you feel that same type of anticipation?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I want people to like it. I mean, it's sort of, it helps me, like I benefit if people like it. And yet I feel like I'm kind of at the point in my life where if someone doesn't like it, that I'm not going to be, or that my sense of well-being or that my choice of what I do with my time isn't so contingent on the opinion of someone else.
Right.
You know, like I'd like to kind of, like I think, I don't think it means, like if someone doesn't like a piece, I don't think it means that I've wasted my life.
Right.
You know, like I think that that's okay. And I think I can, there's a space to be held for that kind of dissent, I guess.
Right.
Or, you know, what have you. There's a woman, a brilliant, brilliant theater artist named Anne Bogart, who works out of New York and has been in kind of the, I don't know if they'd want to build themselves as avant-garde theater artists. But she's just a brilliant mind in theorizing about the artistic process, and they make very, very interesting work as a theater company. And she said something once that always stuck with me that was, it was about how she gets feedback, because she directs these pieces and is sort of kind of like as a director, like sees herself as a kind of a surrogate audience member to try to take this in. If she gets a note, like basically gets feedback from someone, really listens to the conversation inside of her to say, like, if she gets defensive about it or angry about a piece of feedback, it's a sign to her that there's actually probably some valuable information in there.
Right.
And that there is probably something to be looked at.
That's it.
Whether it's exactly what the person is saying it is or not, that there's probably something there. If there's no feeling at all, then she feels free to kind of toss it out and move on. Like it could just be, well, that's just not that person's cup of tea, or
right.
they just don't get it or whatever. But if someone says, that joke's stunk, and I feel kind of defensive, and we all, like, the more we can kind of listen to that conversation inside, I think the better apt we are to be able to navigate that information that comes back from the outside world.
Well, I think what you're talking about there is probably one of the biggest challenges that we face as a human species, and that is this ability to be able to look inward and to ask ourselves, why am I feeling that way? Whether it's in an artistic process or whether or not it's, you know, you're in a relationship and someone in the relationship one night just says something flippantly over dinner, and you feel, like we've all had these moments, you feel your body changing, you feel yourself sweating, or you feel yourself, you're something's happening, right? And and a lot of people just think to themselves, they'll quite often just project the problem onto the other individual. Well, it's, you know, he's just, well, of course I'm sweating, my husband's an idiot, or of course Of course, I'm having my stomach's turning in this business meeting because that person is just a cocky bastard. And it's like, that's sure, you can absolutely choose to take that perspective, or you can go and do the work and look inward and say, okay, well, all right, let's just say for a second, let's shelf that. That person is a cocky bastard, but maybe there's something going on with me. Maybe it even goes back as far as when I was a kid, that somebody who represented the same types of characteristics as this person used to push me around at recess. And really what it comes down to, this person is only subconsciously reminding you of that. I mean, this is where, life, this is where we say life takes work, and it's work that most people are too afraid to do.
Yeah. I mean, I hope that's not the case. It seems, I mean, it is radical work. Really, mm-hmm. I mean, to be at the edge of your own experience takes a lot of energy and a lot of courage because, like you say, when the feeling that, you know, you have before you kind of diving off into the unknown, I mean, that's what's happening. If we're really being honest, we have the opportunity to kind of create ourselves in every new moment. Mm-hmm. And that can be... I'm not frightening. I mean, I understand why people like, and I have compassion for it because I'm not always on my edge. Mm-hmm. And I see that all the time, particularly, I don't know if it relates to age, but I think there's a certain time, you know, where people pull back or they think, okay, this is where I'm parked now and I'm just going to circle the wagons and,
right.
And stay here. So, I mean, it's the work of the life. And I think, I hope people will dare to go as far as they're able, because I think it just will make for a more interesting place.
I agree. Because I know you've done a lot of self-development and work on yourself. And I think that, you know, you are an interesting individual in many ways. But one in particular that I think people should know is the fact that you used to make a living off of in the world of real estate. I think it's a safe way to say it. And then somewhere you thought,
yeah,
I should write movies. And which a lot of people, I'm sure, have had those kinds of thoughts, and they have worked on it for about a day and then thought to themselves, hold on, nobody makes money doing that.
Yeah, exactly. Stop having those thoughts.
Yeah, if you're having those thoughts now.
Don't write screenplays.
Yeah, definitely. Stay in real estate. But what in the process of all the development that you've done on yourself, what is one thing that you're most proud of that you have been able to accomplish, like whether it's a fear you've overcome or whether it's some sort of self-development thing that you've done that you look back at and you're different today than you were before?
Wow, that's an excellent question.
I'm kind of putting you on the spot, I know, but...
Well, no, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is this moment where, and I don't know if it's really a definable moment, but like, well, it is a definable moment, but it'll be maybe difficult. Well, okay, I'll just attempt it.
Okay.
I remember when, okay. Are we losing people?
I think we just, 10 just dropped off for sure.
stick around. This might be good.
When I say 10, I mean all 10.
All right, now I can relax.
No, it's just you and I now, buddy. It's just you
just
and me.
You and me. Just you and me in Stapleton.
Right.
So I guess, I mean, what was the question again?
What is something that you're most, you know, you're most proud of, or something that you can identify that you're really, you know, it's a great self-development, something that you did in the world of self-development for yourself that you may have never expected that you'd be doing today, or that you're thinking today about yourself or seeing yourself as?
Well, okay. I think the thing that pops through is where I went through a major, crossed a major threshold, I think. I was in Los Angeles at the time, and I had been writing for a few years. I hadn't really had much. I'd had some jobs and worked on some big projects, but no major success. I was still kind of writing projects on spec, which, you know, means no one pays you to write them, but if a producer might like an idea, and then you would go away on your own and write it, and then it's kind of like a way of, I don't know, like you just sort of have identify someone that says, yeah, if you execute this idea decently enough, I'd be interested in maybe taking that further.
Right.
So I was kind of, I didn't like these projects that I was working on. I didn't like the people I was working with. It felt really confining, and I came to a point of a real crisis mm-hmm. where I had, all the air went out of the room and I didn't know what to do. And I think because there was nothing else I wanted to do. And yet if what I wanted to do, what I was doing had to look like the way it was looking, I knew I couldn't do that anymore either. So it was a real, dilemma.
Right.
Because there was nowhere to go. They were completely, it was a dilemma in the truest sense of the word. Mm-hmm. World. I'm prone to dramatic language, but like it was, I felt like my survival was really at stake. So the actual answer to the question was my ability to completely surrender,
right?
To completely be willing to let go of how I had approached my work and myself up until that point.
Mm-hmm.
And then something new came, something new was born in that, out of that surrender.
So that you're saying that you maybe 10 years earlier would not have been able to surrender?
I don't think so. I certainly hadn't been called to it in that way. Mm-hmm. I hadn't really come to that edge yet.
Right.
And so I feel like what I feel proud of was that I had the willingness and wherewithal to go through that that crucible.
Right.
I know this all sounds very abstract, but it was just that willingness to really be willing to let all of that go.
Right.
And those ideas, the attitudes, the beliefs about what it meant to be a writer, why I was pursuing this,
mm-hmm.
What would happen if that never happened.
Right.
Like if I wasn't ever able to complete anything or if it wasn't any good, like what of my life then?
Yes.
Then what would it be? Particularly because, like you say, I was in business before. I did a business degree, which is what we both did. And, we have a lot of commonality in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
And yet our ambitions and our ambitions and the things that occurred to us to want to do, exceeded beyond the cookie cutter, business path.
Right.
But whatever that means, I think you know what I mean. But
it's Procter & Gamble. just in case you're right, it's Procter & Gamble. Okay, go on. Just lost them as a sponsor.
And, there's so many tangents we could go on. And it's all interesting to me.
Yeah.
So there was all that extra pressure. Like I feel like the very skills that had got me to the point that I had enough money in the bank that I could finance my transition into writing,
mm-hmm.
where I didn't need to worry for a little bit that this next script had to put food on my table.
Mm-hmm.
The very skills that and strategic mind that got me to that point was not the thing that was going to get me to the next place. It wasn't
right.
going to get me across that bridge. It wasn't going to be the part of me that was going to create any work that was that had any weight to it.
Right.
And so it was the moment of me being willing to step to take the part of myself that was driving my bus in my life up until that point, and be willing to have it take the back seat for some new nascent part to come forward that was going to go from here on in. So it was like, I think about that image of the rockets and I'm not a rocket man, but you know, like the old rockets, I don't know if they have these things like when they send the rockets up, there's like the big engine that gets them out of the atmosphere.
Right. Yeah.
And then once it takes it as far as it can, it falls away and it gives makes room for another that other part to kind of keep going.
That's a great analogy.
It gets propelled by something else. Thank you.
Did you think of that yourself?
I don't know. I've heard it. I've probably heard it spoken before, but
I'd own that. I'd take that if I were you. That just I've never heard it, and I've been in the industry for a long time. That's all yours now. You know, when I'm listening to you speak, one of the things that crosses my mind, and I'm not suggesting that this is what you're saying, but it's somewhat indicative of this, and this has been a big thing for me, there's a beautiful moment when you're willing and I guess just say you're willing and accepting of the idea of quote-unquote failure. Because I got to tell you that society, of course, says, let's say for you, that you, in order for you to be successful as a writer, society would probably, if you were to take a survey, it would mean that you probably have to sell a certain number of scripts to a certain number of TV stations, a certain number of films, and then say, oh, yes, okay, there you go. Doug Barber, he is a success. For me, there's a different criteria. And there have been times where I found myself, you know, intrinsically aware of what the criteria is. And there have been moments where I've been sitting there going, holy crap, I'm actually not going to hit the target. I'm not going to do it. Whether it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago or moments when I was really in debt or moments when I had spent all the money of the business on an idea that I thought was going to take us to the next level and it only took us down two notches. And in those moments, when I'm fretting, when I can't sleep for a couple of nights, when I'm not eating well and really just attached to this idea that I'm not going to meet society's standards of success, it's in those moments where I actually become accepting of the idea of failure. And that has got to be one of the most beautiful experiences that I've had on many occasions. And when it happens, I find that the next thing, like you said, comes your way. It's almost as if you're speaking out to God or the universe or Allah or Buddha, and you're saying, you know what? I'm okay with the idea that the plan that I had not working. I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm okay with it maybe not necessarily making me very popular in the eyes of other people. So because I'm so okay with that, I'm freeing up room now for you to send something else my way. And it seems like the second that I let go is that moment when something brand new does seem to arrive. And it's funny though, right? Because I know that. And then the next time I find myself in that situation, I'll do it again. I'll have to go through the stress before I let go.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I think that's just a very human experience. And
yeah,
it's a sign that we're in the game.
Mm-hmm. What was it like? Can I ask you a quick question? What was it like for you when you would be having these moments? Now, I know that you are good friends with Sandra Oh from Grey's Anatomy, and Sandy's a fantastic lady, and have had the chance to meet her a few times. And I know that you and her were living in, together in Los Angeles, not together as a couple. You were a roommate. I thought,
oh, no.
Oh God, this is it. We're dead.
Now I'm constricting again.
Anyway, point is, you would have been being friends with someone like Sandra, or being friends with other friends that we both have that are extremely successful individuals in the world of film and television,
mm-hmm.
only puts you into an environment where you are surrounded by other very successful people. Was that challenging for you to be this kind of emerging writer surrounded by people who had probably sold scripts to Warner Brothers?
Well, I don't know if it was super challenging to me. I mean, in some ways, I think that's a good point, and it's a good question, and I think it's something that I actually have a lot to say about that. That type of thing, particularly like for anyone like living in Los Angeles that's looking to have a creative career in this cultural world. And I say Los Angeles primarily because that's kind of where the big, you know, all of the, you know, that's the epicenter of culture, whether you like it or not,
right.
or not. You know,
yeah.
movies and TV, it's all kind of based there. And you can walk around and you don't, whether you, whether you're close friends with someone famous or you don't have to, or not, you don't have to go very far before you have some connection with them.
Right.
And you think, well, why not me?
Mm-hmm.
Like they're not necessarily the most, and I'm not speaking about, Sandra here, cause I think she's incredibly talented, but like,
of course
you look at that, you try to, you just look at anybody who's quote unquote successful and you think, well, they're not the most talented or they're not the most,
charismatic, you know, or, yeah.
Yeah, they're not the most whatever, but mm-hmm. they're in that position. And then you can have, I think that's a hugely dangerous conversation to get into with yourself. Because it's like, I think we have to protect ourselves from that so much, that what happens after we make a work, like the result that happens out in the world, we can't take that personally.
Right.
I think.
Yeah.
I think that's hugely, hugely damaging. And I think it can negatively affect how one creates things. Cause then you get into the, and I'm curious how this is for you too, because like there are, I don't know, the pressure to create something that is going to, quote, work, or like how to, you know,
well, I struggle,
how something is going to be received.
I struggle with this quite a bit, and it's funny because just today I was thinking that my next newsletter is going to be about jealousy, because I suffer from jealousy from time to time, and in my industry especially, there are individuals that can use social media and they can use technology to make themselves look way more qualified and way more popular than they actually are. I mean, anybody listening to this, if they don't know, you can actually purchase a Twitter following now. And you can get these algorithms out there that you purchase that will just automatically start feeding you with more Twitter followers. And so I see people in my industry sometimes who are getting things that I don't feel like they deserve. And I feel, I don't know, kind of small saying this out loud. I feel a bit embarrassed almost saying this, but it's true. I want to be truthful.
Yeah.
And I see them having, let's say, 50,000 followers on Twitter, and I'll think to myself, and then because of that, they end up getting certain speeches that I was more qualified for. And
right.
because I've been in the game for years longer than they have, and they've just used the system to get ahead. And I just start finding myself thinking, well, that's not fair. That's not right. And you get jealous and you get angry. It's like that person shouldn't have got that book deal. That person shouldn't have got that gig. And it's a constant battle. I have to actually do work where I'll look and say, oh yeah, well somebody, you know, there's one guy in my industry who I know who has something like 100,000 followers on Twitter. But the big joke is that he follows probably about 100,000 people. Right. So
right.
These people have just followed him back, and it just seems so inauthentic, yet it doesn't matter what I think because he still gets speeches out of it. And to me, that is irritating. And it's that irritation that I have to battle with. You know, I'm only human. No matter how successful I am, I'm only human. And so, yeah, it's part of my own self-development.
No, I hear you. There's a book I just pulled off my shelf. It's called The Gift, written by a guy named Lewis Hyde. And if people, you know, if anyone is kind of struggling with that question, it's I think it's a really worthwhile thing to pop into. The essence of it is that just kind of underscoring the need for anyone that creates something that they want to offer out to the world. To separate that from the expectation of ever getting anything back from it.
Right.
Maybe we need to kind of let that land, let breathe for a second, because like, it's kind of a radical idea.
Sure.
And potentially confounding for anyone that then says, well, we all need to be solvent. We need to keep our lights on. We need to put food on our table.
Uh-huh.
But I think that essential, human experience of gift giving, of saying, here, I made this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm offering this to share it with you. And now I'm moving on. And maybe, like, because there's so many examples of famous artists that never made a living in their lifetime doing what they did.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And so how do we then, like, again, this sort of comes back to that same, that major turning point in my life. Like I don't want to, go around and with this diminished sense of myself, if for some reason the marketplace, I'm not able to connect with the marketplace in a way with my work that, maybe some of my friends or people that I know or even just know of have done.
Exactly.
So that's not to say that there isn't a place for that strategic thinking, and maybe buying Twitter followers is the right move. And maybe it's like you just try a bunch of stuff. It's all sort of a big experiment, but I think we need to, if our sense of well-being in our lives is tied to a particular result happening from the outside world, I mean, that's not a place where I want to live anymore.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm working on a new speech right now, and I told myself, I said, I am going to write this as if no one's ever going to hear it. And I'm going to write this for me. And I'm going to write this because this is something that I would love to put out there. But I'm not going to worry about what people's reactions might be, because the second I write something and worry about people's reactions in some sort of subconscious way, it's going to taint or diminish what it is that I'm doing. And so, and I think this, isn't this true? And we know that the greatest things that have ever happened in the history of time have always come from a place of a person not worrying about the result, but just doing the thing because it felt right.
Right.
You know, whether that be a song. I mean, I doubt that any of the greatest songs that anyone of us listens to that we all love was ever written when someone said, oh, you know what, I'm going to deliberately write this because I think it'll be a hit. As you know, they write it because they're like, this is what feels right to me, and I need to get it off my chest. And I think that's true for being like a great father too, right? If the greatest fathers are the ones, and the greatest mothers are the ones that just pour love into that child without any expectation of anything in return, or you can apply it to any party, but whether you're being a great brother or a great sister or a great coach or a great, hockey player, if you go into that game with the intention of just being the absolute best because you want to be the best you can be without concern of what other people think of you, you're going to be your best.
Oh my God. Yeah. I feel like, as you're saying that, I feel this pressure in my chest kind of clamping down, like, because, like, even though I can, you know, I like this thing about writing that speech for yourself. I mean, I think I just, even after everything I've said, I still hear that and just hold my hands together and go, yes, please, can I get to that point? Can I still get there? Like, it's one thing to know it and another thing to still be right on that frontier with you and the page and saying, what is that? What is that thing that you don't care what the reaction is? Like, I really still feel like I have a long way to go to cultivate a place where failure is totally cool.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'd be lying if I said I was there. I feel like it's something I get better at. I mean, I sometimes will find myself driving down the street or coming back from a speech and I'll start, you know, speaking out loud or in my own head, and I'll be almost picturing myself on stage saying something to an audience. And it's stuff that scares the crap out of me to write down. And yet after I say it out loud, I think, God, man, that is some brilliant shit. Too bad no one's ever going to hear it. Because by the time I get home, I'll be too afraid to say it out loud. Yeah.
What's your report card like on yourself? And that I'm interested in the corporate world, because that's, you know, where you're spending a lot of time now. What kind of willingness is there, do you see in that world to really participate in this kind of way?
You know, it's funny.
Like, is that,
It's a great it's a great question, Doug. I'll tell you something. With all the work that I've done with all my corporate clients, and when it comes right down to it, I've been, you know, I really, these people that I work with are great people. They're great moms and dads. They've got a great zest for life. They're funny. And so I do like these people as people. However, the corporate world, and it's not just Canada, anywhere, is a community, or it is, I don't know, it's its own little entity. It's its own country. I don't know what you want to call it, but it is so confined. And when you hear examples of companies like Google or Apple doing things that are, you know, well off the beaten path, where they allow, let's say, their employees to have afternoon siestas, or there's no limits on how many breaks they can have during a day. I mean, when they start doing these what would be considered radical things, and of course, we all know they end up getting fantastic results because of it, that is so rare. I mean, 99.9% of the corporate market is still so afraid to be real. And I believe that it is really getting in the way of our corporate Canada or corporate the world's corporate ability to come up with really great products. We think we've got great products right now, like with the iPhone or with the computers that we have. And yes, they are great, but the greatness of those products could be so much bigger and so much more fantastic if corporations were less afraid, to take a risk with a particular invention or design, less afraid to put out a commercial that might offend somebody, or less afraid of calling somebody out in a meeting for saying something stupid. You know, it's amazing in how many meetings I've been in and I hear somebody say something that is ridiculous. But because they've got director behind their name or vice president behind their name, everybody in the room just nods like it's the most brilliant thing they'd ever heard. And that's fine. That will allow you to keep your job, no question. But it's not going to make that company great. It's going to make them they'll be successful to a certain extent. But to be absolutely great, whether it's an individual or whether it's a company, you need to be committed to that transparency of speaking your truth, being real, not being afraid to say something that perhaps is not going to be aligned with the popular opinion of the day. And if you're willing to, companies that are willing to do that, I believe will always exceed well above and beyond their competition. Yet most companies are, it's like what we said, you were saying at the beginning of this conversation, there's too much on the line. Whereas you might say to yourself, well, if I spend 6 months writing the script that really comes from my heart, it may be so radical for people that I may just never have anybody want to hire me as a writer again, thus making it so that I'll never be able to put food on the table. I believe that companies kind of suffer on a grand scale in the same way, where they'll say, well, if we put out a commercial like that, or if we put out a product like that, or whatever, if we start having a new rule that says we're allowed to cut down anyone's idea, no matter what position they hold in the organization, there's this fear that the company will implode upon itself. Mm-hmm. And so they just don't take the risk and they just kind of go the easy route. And this is why I believe that we as a species take, you know, 500 years to move a distance that should have just taken 50.
Yeah.
And it's too bad. It's too bad. And there's nothing that I'm going to say on this show or you're going to say to your friends or to me that's going to change it anytime soon. I mean, I believe we're moving in a direction. There's definitely a lot of people that are, I guess, leaders that are taking those risks and making it okay. But unfortunately, not enough of them right now.
I know. I think about that and I get tired and I want to go to sleep because it seems so big and overwhelming, and then I hear that and I think, okay, well, what do I do? And I'm already doing it. I've already kind of created my life around following what I care about and what I think is important. But I think that's, you know, if more people do that as individuals, then I think that's sort of, I don't know, I just have to think that will work itself out, because it's sort of, I agree with you.
If someone is willing to do, if like it all comes down to role models and mentorship. So when I see somebody taking a risk and doing something that maybe scares me, and I see them coming out and unscathed, or they didn't die in the process, they didn't go bankrupt, I start thinking to myself naturally, well, maybe I could take a bit more risk in my life. And if I do that, then I think there's a ripple effect that the person watching me is going to be willing to do it as well. So we are seeing it. There are CEOs and companies that are taking those risks. There are, you know, certain politicians that are beginning to say things today that politicians wouldn't have said 30 or 40 years ago. And I think within communities, we're seeing people take certain risks or standing up and speak certain truths that is inspiring people on a grassroots level. And I think that we'll see the ripple effect in years to come. I mean, if you just think about, I love thinking about how the fact that it really wasn't long ago that women couldn't vote, or it really wasn't long ago that the idea of gay marriage would have seemed like the most preposterous thing ever. And I could give a list of examples that are just like that. And when I think about that, I do get excited, and I get excited about what could possibly happen in 50 years from now, or another 100 years from now. And so I think that we are on that right track. I think that there's going to probably be a few major kind of apocalyptic moments in our life. And I don't mean that from a religious perspective. I just mean that we will make some catastrophic mistakes, whether it's with the environment or whether it's with, avoiding the fact that we're, you know, becoming diseased through stress, whatever. There'll be another kind of a checking point that we have to go through. But I think that once we get through those checkpoints, we are going to come out on top, and that our world is amazing right now. But it's going to be, I mean, amazing in ways that I think that most people can't even fathom. Which I'm glad that we're saying this, by the way, because I think that sometimes when you and I, and we've laughed about this in the past, that when you and I talk, that it can sometimes come across as being extremely depressing. Thank God we rounded it out at the end, where we started talking about that there is hope, and that things are going to be okay.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I guess I was like, really, did we get there yet? how much time? How are we for time?
We've got about usually. We've gone. I don't know, friggin' whatever. I mean, when it comes right down to it, we should probably wrap this up in about 9 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Where is the struggle right now?
For me?
Yeah. What are you struggling with?
What am I struggling with? I would say that I struggle with sometimes making a concrete decision, because I worry that if I make this decision, that I may be missing out on something better in the future. And, you know, I'll think about the idea sometimes of having children, let's say. Well, it's like, oh my God, if you have children, then you're going to be locked in. If you're locked in, that's 20 years, man. So you might miss out on something. Or I struggle with a business decision. If you go down a certain path and with business, you might miss another business opportunity. And so I'm trying to become more secure in just making decisions and having trust that there's a possibility that there may be a certain opportunity cost in making that decision now. But trusting that on the grand scheme of things over a lifetime, all of these decisions, if you don't make them, all of these decisions will lead to something great. And if you don't make them and you're always worried about, you know, something better, then you're never going to make decisions. If you never make decisions, you're going to have a mediocre life. So that's a struggle with me. If I find that now that I'm coming up for the 41st birthday, that I'm looking to make some pretty monumental decisions with my life, with respect to family, with respect to where I'm going to live.
Ooh.
Oh, hell yeah.
Wow.
And with respect to where I'm going to live, or with respect to business, and they're bigger decisions than I've ever had to make before. But I'm still excited. I'm excited about them too. So how about you? How's business going? Are you going to be on like getting an Oscar anytime soon, or what?
Well, I don't know about an Oscar, but I'm really happy to be working. I've probably had the most successful start of the year that I've ever had. I've just completed just like within like a day ago, finished the, I've just written three TV movies basically in the last couple months with my partner James.
Excellent.
James Phillips.
So
it's great. The first one's going into production in a few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other ones will be made throughout the year. And I think we've got a good thing going. So it's been really satisfying creatively and business-wise. And now I'm moving into my new apartment.
Oh, really? Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
You must chuckle sometimes, eh? Thinking to yourself that it doesn't seem long ago when you were in the world of business, you were in the world of real estate, and that now you'll, if you want, we're doing this recording on a Friday, you can and you're living in Vancouver, and you could easily go out the door and have a beer and know that it's being paid for by money that you make as an actual writer. Do you ever just laugh to yourself?
I mean, right now when I think about it, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
Like it's kind of great.
Did you know that that's what you do for a living?
Well, yeah, but it feels like I spend so much time just in my room. It's often in such a vacuum and the process of writing something that I'm getting paid for versus not getting paid for is very similar.
Mm-hmm.
So it almost like you pull the head up and look around and go, oh, right, I actually get a check for that. And
yeah,
that's pretty cool. No, it's great. I mean, it's great. Like,
yeah, I just think it's so impressive. I love it. I love that you've done this with your life. What would be, you know, as we maybe, you know, close off this this show, what would be one mm-hmm. piece of advice that you would give people that are considering or who want to take a tangent in their lives and they want to go down a different path? You know, what do you think that people need to know or need to believe in order to do that?
I think there has to just be a willingness to whatever that is, to have it be entirely yours and not like living. You may get inspired by an image of someone else's life, but it really, I think, for the love of God, has to be your own life, whatever that happens to be. And so there's a call to ask that question of one's inner self, and then have the guts to do whatever it takes to kind of shepherd that out into the world.
Do you believe that everyone's meant to do something that is kind of just true to them and that's unique to them?
I really do. I really do. And I think we've all had, it may not be so easily translatable into a known job on a list of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be being a parent, you know, whatever that is. I mean, it's worth almost a trip back to our childhood to kind of where if you know, the moments that we're in doubt about these things, and this doesn't always bear fruit, but like to kind of just see like what horizon was I just naturally drawn to? What did I like this question, like what do I really love?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I don't know what brings me joy. Like, what am I drawn to? What would I like before I knew that I was supposed to be anything?
Right.
What did I like to do?
Yeah.
Why did I go to this place as opposed to that place? And so I think that's the essential conversation of migrating to and really inhabiting our adulthood is like, this is the opportunity now. Like, you know, when we're kids, we're told, okay, this is how you need to be. To survive in this environment, and that helps us. And then then the game is really about, okay, what am I going to do with this life?
Right, right. You know, it's funny.
And so, yeah.
I think two quick things I want to throw in there before the end of the show here that you just made me think of. The first is that You have to give yourself permission to do things that you love. And that's something I think a lot of people struggle with, that they don't believe that on some level that they deserve it, that maybe somebody who gets to do what they really love doing is just somebody who's special. They're the lucky ones. And that I for whatever reason, based on whatever town I grew up in or whatever family I was born to, I didn't fall into that category. So I think the first thing people have to really do is make sure that they give themselves permission to recognize that everybody deserves to be able to spend a certain amount of time each day or each week doing that thing that they love. And like you said, whether it's parenting or whether it's being a NASA space scientist, you have to give yourself permission to do that. And the second thing is to recognize that it doesn't always mean you need to quit your job and do some other radically different job. It could be just giving yourself permission. Even if you're a parent, you've got three kids, and I know you're busy and you've got a full-time job, even then, just saying, no, I give myself permission 2 hours a week to do this one thing I love, which is to make crafts or to work out or to build rowboats. I don't care what it is. You've given yourself permission to do that. And if you're not doing that, then to me, you're doing a disservice to your life.
I agree. I think that's how the big things get created, are those in those moments of giving yourself over to that, whatever that thing is for you. Yeah.
Well, and I think we need you to do it. We need people to do it because it only makes, you know, all of our lives better. So, listen.
Well, because in the end, it's like, what else are you going to do?
Right. Yeah.
What's
the alternative?
What's the alternative?
Yeah. The alternative is to be unhappy.
Yeah. So.
Well, we've done both. And I can tell you, one is not better than the other. Or one, I should say.
You know what? I'd still rather be having this struggle, frankly, than, you know, it's not like the struggle goes away, but like, at least this is the right struggle for me to be having.
Right.
And that it took some bumps and bruises to get for the privilege to have this particular struggle.
Yes.
And that I'm grateful for.
Yeah, that's one thing you and I have always agreed upon, is that when we have our when we commiserate over the phone and we talk about some of the frustrations we're going through, we always end up saying the same thing. We always come back and say, "But would you do it any different?" And the answer would be absolutely not, because we both know that we're more alive in the middle of the struggle and the challenges and the beautiful moments and the mucky moments. We're more alive there than we would be with the alternative. And I think that is something that I only wish for every human being that's hearing this, or that's on the planet for that matter. So, but
me too.
Yeah, we've come to a good part to break the conversation, but I'm going to get you to stay on the line, but I really want you to know that I really appreciate you taking the time to have a conversation with me. It's always, it's great, because I mean, I'm essentially doing a podcast with friends where I not only create a show, but I also have a catch-up session.
Yeah, I think it's great. I'm really glad I got over my reluctance, because I do, you know, it's great for me to hear this too and be reminded of it. And I think it's really, it's the essential conversation to have. So I am happy to be able to share that.
Awesome. Well, thanks very much, Doug. Hold on the line, but this has been Doug Barber, the filmmaker and writer extraordinaire. Is there anything, if anyone wants to, I'll give him a little shout out about, you know, how you can contact Doug if that's the way we decide to go. And I will keep Doug on the line, but thanks for tuning in, and stay tuned. There's a couple more things I want to share with you.
The number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
Thank you for tuning in to The Stuart Knight Show. We hope you've enjoyed this powerful conversation. People are fascinating, and so are you. And the right questions will prove it.
Well, thanks for tuning in, everyone. I really appreciate your time this week. For those of you who want to learn more about Doug Barber or want to stay in his world, you can check out his website at creativedreamwork.com. That's creativedreamwork.com. Or you can follow him on Twitter at Doug_Barber. That's Doug_Barber. And for those of you who want to follow me, you can at Stuart _Knight on Twitter, or you can like my fan page on Facebook. And finally, it would mean the world to me if you just took a few seconds out of your day to share this podcast with your network. I mean, you can do that on Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn or wherever you show up in cyberspace. It would be fantastic if you could do that, because we want to make sure that we engage the world in a powerful conversation. I think together we can make that happen. So please, if you could, share it now. And I look forward to connecting with all of you again next week. Until then, remember, powerful conversation, powerful life.